This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
There were 102 when they got on the Mayflower ship, sailed across to America, and in the first winter, over half of them died.
That's Lee Filson, CEO of CE Plymouth, says Americans are celebrating the Thanksgiving holiday today, just as the pilgrims did hundreds of years ago. Details coming up. Also, the Israeli and Hamas deal for a four-day ceasefire and the release of some hostages delayed until tomorrow. And Niger's military ruler, General Abdourahamane Tiani, arrived today in Mali to meet his counterpart, Colonel Assim Goïta. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Israel's National Security Advisor said the release of hostages under a temporary truce agreement with Hamas will not happen before Friday. It is expected that at least 50 hostages will be freed by Hamas during a four-day ceasefire under a new deal with Israel brokered by the Qatar and the United States. In exchange, Israel will release 150 prisoners who were indicted for their previous involvement in terror activities, a deal the Council General says was made with a heavy heart. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has vowed to continue the war against Hamas after the truce expires, with the goal of destroying the group's military capabilities, ending its 16-year rule in Gaza, and returning all of the estimated 240 captives held in Gaza by Hamas and other groups. For the latest from the region, we have reporter Linda Gradstein standing by in Jerusalem. Welcome to Africa News Tonight.
Thank you so much, Yehiyas.
So why the delay, Linda?
Well, it's not exactly clear why the delay. I've sort of heard two versions of this. One is that it was just kind of procedural issues. The other was that Hamas is insisting that the released hostages go to Egyptian hospitals and not be taken by the Red Cross directly to Israel, and Israel is insisting that they go directly to Israeli hospitals. It appears that's been ironed out, and they will be taken to Israeli hospitals. But there's something a little strange about the timing. A spokesman for Qatar's foreign ministry said that the ceasefire will start at 7 a.m. local time tomorrow, and the first group of 13 hostages would only be freed 9 hours later at 4 p.m. Now, until now, Israel has said that the ceasefire won't actually start until the first group of hostages are freed.
And Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, as I just said, had vowed to continue the war against Hamas after the truce expires, with the goal of destroying the group's military capabilities. Is that a good incentive?
Well, I think, you know, the idea is that during this ceasefire, a large amount of aid will be able to come into Gaza, food, fuel, medicine. Right now, more than 1 million people have left northern Gaza, and so southern Gaza is now hosting 2.2 million people, and the conditions are getting really, really bad. Look, I think the idea is that the hostages would be freed. Hamas would have a break. Israel says that if Hamas surrendered, it would stop fighting. But Israel, I think, says that it won't stop until Hamas can no longer be a military threat. I think that what happened on October 7th, what's called Black Saturday here, the Hamas massacre of 1,200 civilians, was such a shock to Israelis that they feel that the only chance for any kind of an eventual peaceful solution between Israelis and Palestinians is if Hamas is not part of the picture.
And at last, we've heard from Pope Francis, who actually, in an unscripted remark yesterday, said, you know, that both sides are suffering during meetings with the Israeli relatives of Hamas-held captives and with Palestinians who have families in Gaza. And this is, he said, what wars do. Has that resonated in any way with both sides?
Well, first of all, one of the people who met the Pope is my friend Rachel Goldberg-Poland, whose son Hirsch is believed to be one of the people who was kidnapped. His arm was blown off at his at the elbow, and for, you know, 7 weeks she has not known if her 23-year-old son is alive or not. And he would not be part of this hostage release in any case, as the 50 hostages that we're talking about in this first 4 days is only women and children. That said, I know on the Israeli side there was some disappointment that the Pope kind of seemed to make the two sides equivalent. In other words, from the Israeli perspective, Hamas started the war. Israel didn't start the war. And so to sort of compare them, I think from the Palestinian side, the Pope's remarks were welcomed. As you and I have talked about repeatedly, there's been a tremendous amount of destruction in Gaza. In fact, you know, they're not sure once the fighting ends where people will be able to go back home to, those who live in northern Gaza, because whole neighborhoods have been destroyed.
And talking about pressure from the international community, now Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi has urged leaders of the world's 20 big economies to do whatever necessary to ensure the Israeli-Hamas conflict does not expand into a wider conflict.
Right. There's definitely concern about expansion to a wider conflict. Look, Egypt's economy is already suffering. Tourism to the Middle East has basically stopped. You know, when these kinds of things happen, even if it's localized between Israel and Hamas, tourism to Israel has completely stopped. So I think there is definitely concern that it could spread. I know in Israel, you know, I was just listening to the radio, and some of those evacuated from communities near Gaza, the government is paying for them to stay in hotels, but there is not covering their, you know, other expenses, and small businesses are on the verge of closing. And I think that's happening really all over, you know, the Middle East. And there's definitely concern of sparking a global crisis.
Linda Granstein, briefing us on the latest from the region. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
A new study by the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace says Hamas's brutal attacks on Israel civilians and military personnel on October the 7th and the harsh Israeli response in Gaza, with its high toll of civilian death and destruction, show that procrastination in solving the Palestinian-Israeli conflict can have a high and continuing cost. The Biden administration has repeatedly announced its commitment to a two-state solution. Past crises in the Middle East have given birth to new initiatives. Amar Hamzawi, director of the Carnegie's Middle East program and co-author of the study, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi whether this one could produce a more successful outcome.
I believe it's very difficult to judge whether international actors such as the United States, especially since it's approaching an election year, what is going to be a very polarizing election year, 2024, as well as European countries, which are engaged in domestic polarization as well between different groups due to different security risks, as well as challenging social and economic developments. I wonder whether the United States and Europe will find the commitment, the strategic commitment, to immerse themselves in conflict resolution in the Middle East in solving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. We therefore, my co-author Nathan Brown and myself, we actually go in a different direction. We suggest that this time it's on the region, primarily on key Arab countries, to come forward with a renewal of their peace proposal, which was put forward in 2002 and labeled the Arab Peace Initiative, which was announced in Beirut in 2002. We're suggesting a renewal of the Arab peace process based once again on the principles of land for peace, on the principle of the two-state solution, on the principle of regional inclusion and regional security arrangements. This proposal, if put forward by key Arab countries such as Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, as a neighboring country of the West Bank and East Jerusalem, of course, as well as additional countries, that it can lead to creating a conducive environment in the region and can probably solicit international actors' integration in the process, but to wait for the US or Europe to play the key role they played before in the 1990s in the Madrid Conference or in the signing of the Oslo agreements in 1993. I believe this is, given the domestic situation in the US and Europe, this is very unlikely.
Would the agreed-upon limited ceasefire create a momentum, and are regional parties willing and ready to seize the moment and help get the Israelis and Palestinians out of the current spiral of violence?
Signing an agreement on a permanent ceasefire is very different from what we're having now. What we're having now is an agreement to exchange hostages, Israeli hostages, for Palestinian detainees in Israeli prisons. We have an agreement on holds to the ongoing military operation of Israeli forces in Gaza. We do not have an agreement on a permanent or a medium-term ceasefire, which is why it's very, very difficult to base any expectations on the halts of operations, which were agreed upon for 4 days. I'm not saying that this is an insignificant agreement. It's an important agreement. It helps to lower at least the number of atrocities committed in recent days. It probably protects civilian lives. It probably protects Palestinian civilians from forced displacement within Gaza Strip itself, but it does not in itself offer for a political solution. It does not in itself entice regional actors or international actors to get the contenders, Israelis and Palestinians, to sit at the negotiating table and start negotiating. It's a breakthrough. It's a diplomatic breakthrough, which is important to build on, but in itself, it's not enough to start imagining a negotiation setting, a negotiation framework. That, in order to be able to imagine that, it takes a bigger announcement. It takes a higher commitment from regional actors, I believe. I have to say Nathan Brown and I continue to believe, and a gradual commitment and interest from national actors such as the U.S., because once again, there's a big difference between the U.S. administration stating that the two-state solution is the path forward and the U.S. administration doing basically nothing throughout the last years to keep the two-state solution alive, which was trampled to death before October 7th.
That was Amar Hamzawi, director of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace's Middle East program, speaking with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shenawi. You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. Niger's military ruler, General Abdourahamane Tiani, arrived today in Mali to meet his counterpart, Colonel Assimi Goïta. It's Tiani's first international visit since seizing power in July. The Mali presidency says he was scheduled to stay a few hours in Mali's capital, Bamako, and meet Goïta for a friendship and working visit. Niger's neighbors, Mali and Burkina Faso, which are ruled by military leaders who seized power in 2020 and 2022 respectively, have pledged solidarity with Niger's coup leaders. They also plan to strengthen economic ties and are united in the fight against Islamic extremism in their countries. The French news agency AFP says Mali plans to host ministers from the three countries for several meetings in the coming weeks with the aim of ironing out the operational details of the new Sahel alliance. Mali, meanwhile, has indefinitely postponed a presidential election that was scheduled for early 2024. Authorities in north central Nigeria's Niger state say 25 people were killed and dozens injured when a truck overloaded with food items and people crashed. Authorities said the trailer was on its way to Nigeria's economic hub of Lagos when it crashed Tuesday in the Takalafia village in Niger's state Magma district. Safety officials say it is believed some of the passengers wanted to travel with the trailer through Tuesday night to avoid unsafe roads during the day. Nigerian President Bola Tinubu mourned the victims and urged commuters to drive safely, especially as the festive season approaches. Americans are celebrating Thanksgiving today, an annual national holiday in the United States and Canada, celebrating the harvest and other blessings of the past year. Lee Filson, CEO and president of C. Plymouth in the East Coast state of Massachusetts, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam that Thanksgiving is important to U.S. citizens because it is the foundation of the country's democracy and democratic society, which began in Plymouth, Massachusetts, when the Pilgrims arrived on the Mayflower from England in November 1620.
A band of pilgrims, there were 102 when they got on the Mayflower ship, sailed across to America, and in the first winter, over half of them died. And they met up with a place where the Mayflower story was already happening, with the Plymouth Patuxet Wampanoag tribe. And they literally held a peace treaty together, or rather a peace alliance. They had a peace alliance for 52 years, and they were really a model to the nation. And of course, we know it didn't end up that way. And the years went by. But when the pilgrims came, before they landed, they wrote a compact. The compact influenced the U.S. Constitution and the Massachusetts Constitution. And so therein lies the democracy I was talking about. After the first year, they had a three-day harvest feast. And during that harvest feast, there were only 50 or so of them. Over 90 Wampanoag natives showed up. And for 3 days, they ate together. They did games together. They celebrated their first harvest.
That's the beginning of Thanksgiving, right?
It is, yes.
The people that came over on the Mayflower, a lot of them felt persecuted because of their religious beliefs, right?
They did. They came from England first, and then they escaped and went to Holland and lived in Leiden in the Netherlands for 12 years before they actually then got permission to sail on the Mayflower over to the New World. They had been persecuted because they didn't believe in worshiping the Anglican way. They believed in reading the Bible and interpreting the Bible in their own way. And at that time, that was a very bad thing to do, and people were jailed and persecuted and houses burned down and all sorts of things would happen to them.
Now, if you go to Plymouth, you can actually still see some of the things that were there when they first arrived, right? Like Plymouth Rock, and there is a replica of the Mayflower that's there that's pretty much almost exactly the same as the Mayflower, isn't it?
Yes, it was built to match it precisely, and it was given to America by the English people and sailed to America from England as a gift. And it's almost exactly the same as the Mayflower, and that's why it's now called the Mayflower 2. You can get on the ship. So the Mayflower 2 was there. Plymouth Rock, it's always been said that that's the rock that the pilgrims stepped off on in order to get onto land. And for a long time, people laughed at it and they called it a myth, but we don't really know that for certain. And there's been a book written by historian Jim Baker in the last couple of years, which says they very well could have used that rock and taken the shallop from their ship in and gotten off on that rock to get off, because that he's looked at the weather, he's looked at all sorts of things, and it was icy and cold.
That was Lee Lifleson, CEO and president of C. Plymouth, speaking with my colleague Carol Van Dam from Plymouth, Massachusetts today.
Hi, this is Larry London, and I'd like to invite you to a brand new feature coming up on Tuesdays on Border Crossings. And we've got some great guests lined up. We are going to bring you our Tuesday Spotlight Artist of the Week. We will feature and highlight an interview and some live performances. And it's all happening on Border Crossings at 1500 Universal. This is something special that's coming in December on Tuesdays here on The Voice of America.
People across the United States are celebrating Thanksgiving holiday. Organizations and businesses are going an extra mile to feed the homeless during this festive season. I talked to my colleague, VOA's Jackson Mfunganye, who is at the Washington, D.C.'s Karma D.C.'s Feed the Homeless venue.
Hello, Yeheyes. Happy Thanksgiving, my friend. So we are here at Karma DC, which is a live event space venue, a cultural center owned by Ethiopian entrepreneur Binyam. And he's been holding this Feed the Homeless event each Thanksgiving for the last couple of years when he has been operating in this area. We are in Northeast DC, an area where we see a lot of homelessness. Right across from Karma DC is a homeless shelter. Binyam tells me that he has a working relationship with the homeless people that live around here. Many of them, he gets to hire them, give them jobs. And then on Thanksgiving day like this, he will host them for dinner. Today, he's prepared a meal, obviously, with a central part of that meal is the turkey. Homeless people here eating the turkey, enjoying some pie, some vegetables, some rice. The one thing that I haven't seen, though, is the injera, Yeheyes. So you probably will not be very much happy with the menu today.
So, Jackson, Binyam, this is a very big undertaking. How did he ever come up with the idea?
Yeah, so he came up with the idea because, you know, he works in an area where there are so many homeless people. He has to interact with them on a daily basis. Right across from his venue, from the venue, is a big homeless shelter, one of the biggest in Washington, D.C. And he has really like a relationship with the homeless people that are around his business. He told me that he actually has other outreach efforts where he provides employment to them, and you know, they work. He has many other businesses, not just this cultural center. So he says that he tries to work with them to give them meaningful employment. And on a day like this, you know, he brings them together to show their support or to show them support. We see so many volunteers from the Ethiopian American community here today helping prepare the meals, distributing the food and other essential supplies, and, you know, just standing with them, chatting with them, having meaningful conversations and communication, really, just to maintain that relationship with the community.
And this is not just a one-day Thanksgiving charity. It's a year-round helping those who need help.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's not just this. It's not the first time they're doing it. And so on major events, whether it's Christmas, whether it's Thanksgiving, he always hosts events of this nature.
How many people is he going to take care of today? I mean, so, you are there.
So I see a long line right behind me, Yeheyes. I asked him how many people he expects to come for food. He said about 250 or more or less. And yeah, you can see there's a line forming. People are starting to eat. They just started, they opened the food about 20 minutes ago. So you can see the line is forming. And, you know, there's so many happy faces here, Yeheyes.
That was Jackson Mfunganye talking with me from the Washington, D.C.'s Karma D.C.'s Feed the Homeless venue.
VOA Africa presents the latest news about Africa and the world and its news summaries. Africa in Brief airs every day at 400, 500 and 600 UTC. Give us 5 minutes of your time to be brought up to date. Africa in Brief, your trusted source for news.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Nicole Peters, and our engineer, Shogun Chung, Thanks for choosing the Voice of America.